CliffCentral.com.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bonang Mohale. Please have a seat anywhere you like.
Sivukile.
Yeah. I even brought a copy. I've got my own copy. Look at me. I'm organized here. Please sit down. Right over there is perfect. There. Yeah, Pumi will take the extra book. So first of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, my dear brother.
You know, I was...
We are off air, right?
No, we're
so
on.
So I can be myself.
Yeah, you can be yourself. You. Okay, see, I just
we
cover
are
up.
We're uncensored, yeah. So you must always be yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, everybody likes you, huh? I've yet
my
to
My wife
see.
Doesn't.
And yet she's your wife. Long-suffering black woman.
No, everybody likes you. I've been talking about having you on the show. And everyone I say that to, they go, oh, he's such a lovely person. He's such a wonderful man. Says such great things, gets everybody inspired, makes a difference, knows what he's talking about. I don't know how you've managed to do this because there's so few people in the current situation in the world who don't attract negativity. Because a lot of people, the negativity comes for them and they don't know what to do with it. And so they absorb it and it affects them, and it, especially with social media and all of this stuff. This book and the way I've encountered you and the way people talk about you, you seem to be one of those either extremely talented and clever people who've learned how to repel this stuff, or you just don't get involved in it. You don't wallow in that kind of thing, which the rest of us mere mortals seem to be stuck in. How does that happen? Because you really are just this beacon of positivity.
So Cliff, thank you very much. First, you are very kind. Number two, my grandmother used to say, just be yourself. Because when what you think, say and do are one and the same thing, then you don't have a disconnect, a dissonance.
That's integrity, right?
It is, exactly. So it's about knowing that Bonang has a persona, a face at home. That face must be the same at work. It must be the same in your own community and in a broader society. Because if you do that, in fact, you don't even have to have a good memory. Because you're just being yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think...
And you don't have to remember three or four different concurrent events because you're not lying.
Absolutely.
So you don't need to have a different version.
Yeah, so if you wake me up at 2 a.m. and I'm still drowsy, mm-hmm. I don't know whether I'm Arthur or Martha or anything in between, and say, who's your wife?
My, you know.
My original wife is Susan. I don't have to invent it.
Luckily for her, sure.
Wow.
Because she could wake you up at 2 a.m.
And ask you, what's my name?
Absolutely.
So Bonang, first of all, the book is terrific. It's a collection of speeches and articles and excerpts. And I find it fascinating. I mean, first of all, you've given, in a speech that I was present at just a couple of days ago, Business Awards, you gave some very interesting statistics, and you reminded everybody in that audience, and part of why I wanted you here is so that you could paraphrase some of those things. We tend to, it's something that Adrian Gore referred to when he, at the Discovery Leadership Summit not so long ago, when he pointed out we are, first of all, pessimistic about ourselves, and we are wrong about ourselves, and we don't have the ability to correct that pessimism and that wrong. So we end up being stupidly wrong about how bad things are, as opposed to looking at the things that are good and that are working. And maybe that's a human nature thing, because we're programmed to look for bad news and to respond to it to save ourselves. It's like an instinct, right? But the things you said were fascinating to me. I mean, tell Pumi about some of the stuff that you told us about at that awards dinner the other night, about how this is our time in South Africa. This is our time in Africa.
Yep, sis Pumi. Because
I'm not taking Sis Pumi. I'm not taking Sis Pumi. Just Pumi. Thank you.
Me Pumi.
Halala.
Yeah, Runaria Thompa. So first,
she's
what?
Very, very woke this morning. I'm
yes.
Sorry.
So first, this idea of wanting to write a book, it's really very simple. It says, as black people, as people with great natural endowments, we must begin to archive, to chronicle and tell our own stories. It also stems from a realization that black people and women, 24 years into democracy, are still spectators of their own lived experiences. And the context is important, because the context is the one that says the duration of oppression is never determined by the oppressor. It is always determined by the oppressed. It's only when the oppressed say this much and no longer does that stop. So when you constantly go to your oppressors and ask them for permission to be, you are extending your own oppression. Black people are the majority in South Africa. This is our country. The continent has 1.2 billion people, 54 countries that speak 2,000 languages, 30.3 million square kilometers of the coastline. Dubai will kill just to have a tenth of that. But we wake up in the morning and we believe that we are poor. And yet all the mineral resources that the world needs, not just want, are either number one or number two in the world. When you look at the world's best producers of chocolate, we think of Belgium and Switzerland. And yet all the cacao they need comes
from here.
Cote d'Ivoire. At the time that everything tells us, and we have access to information, and it simply says the prices of raw material and commodities are precipitously dropping and coming down. And they will continue to do that for hundreds of years. So why would you want to get into a market that is dying? Mm-hmm. And yet the prices of beneficiated goods and services are going up. Therefore, if you want to pull yourself out of poverty, you want to be in beneficiated goods and services. You don't want to go to the depth of the earth and produce the gold raw as it is. Sell it to India.
Sure.
They beneficiate it. They make rings, jewelry. You buy it at 10 times the price, and then you complain that you have the highest unemployment in the world. There's something wrong with us as a people.
And on the demand side, we've got the youngest, fastest growing, unsaturated market for consumer goods. So on the supply side, which is what you're talking about, we are well placed, and on the demand side, we're well placed. So
exactly.
It's almost like we've got to find a way out of trying to excuse ourselves and blame everything that isn't our fault and everything that we think is outside of our power, when there's so much we can change within our power.
Absolutely. So the Bible says we are imperfect by design, not by accident. But it's the extent to which we try and self-correct, because we have been given the ability to think, to reflect, but also to make choices. Therefore, Africa is poor by the choices they make, especially the choices of leaders they make. The world is full of leaders and people who think of themselves as leaders. And yet, there's a death of leadership. You can be trusted without being trustworthy. You can be doing things for yourself only, and we call you selfish. You do things for others, but with an ulterior motive, expecting something in return, we say you are unselfish. What Africa needs, it's people who do things for others, expecting nothing in return. But doing it because it's a moral obligation.
Do people like that exist?
We should create more. If not, let's make more babies who think like us. Because the son does not need any recognition from anybody. But every day without fail, comes up from the east, sets from the west. You can set your clock by it. Mm-hmm. Rain falls in the dusty hills of Emondlo and Nkandla in KwaZulu-Natal, but also in the deserts of Dubai, where it's not as needed. And it doesn't matter. It says, I have to do this because it is my job. That's how I find fulfillment. This is my purpose. Khalil Gibran says, when you're helping other people, you're fulfilling God's work. Ooh. Therefore, when you call yourself a leader, it's about being the other-centered, not self-centered, because leadership, it's about being genuinely obsessed with the development of others. It starts by saying, I've been there, done that, I've got the t-shirt. Mm. It starts by extending trust, talking straight, starting first with the who and then the what, finding it very easy to palette highlight and celebrate others. Because when you are in love, you don't do things for yourself. You want to please the other person. When I iron my trouser in the morning alone, I do it in a hurry, slap dunk job. But when I do it for Susan, I take my time because I want to please her. When she looks at the time, energy and effort I've put into it, I get 10 times the joy. Therefore, life and the purpose of existing, it's about ensuring that you are fulfilling other people's personal objectives, in that you get joy. So when I give you something, the reason why people live longer is because they find it easy to share the little that they have. The poor people that share have the highest happiness index and they live long. The people who have got their most amount of money, but who hoard, who don't tell other people that they have, who keep it only for themselves, who want more and more and are greedy, they die young. When you frown, you use more energy than when you smile. And when you smile and you laugh, have you ever tried to go to a supermarket and then you look at the teller and you smile? She has no option but to smile back. Therefore, you can affect people react to you. My grandmother used to say, your attitude at the beginning of the day, the task, determines both your observation and expectation. So when you expect to be poor in Africa, when you expect the day to be rotten, when you expect people to relate to you as if you have stolen something, that's exactly how they are going to treat you. When you wake up in the morning and say, glorious Lord, isn't this wonderful and amazing? The world is going to reciprocate that, because if you want something bad enough, even nature works with you in ensuring that you accomplish it. The operative word is wanting it enough. Therefore, for me, as a business person, I'm saying, how can we use the force, the impetus of business for greater good?
Yeah.
Hence the title of the book. It says, lift as you rise. It says you don't have to wait until you are the president, the CEO, the MD of a company. Take two steps, extend a hand, lift another human being, and know the meaning of real triumph and joy. It says in our companies, we can do well by doing good. The two are not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely.
Business cannot be an island of prosperity in a sea of poverty. Because when business does well, society generally does well. This is what prompted the mass exodus of black teachers in the 70s against the virulence of apartheid.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going to bugger off. We coined a phrase that says, each one teach one. Because we knew that we can't just leave it to government. It has to be our job at a personal and individual level. Therefore, when we say servant leadership, we say we expect people to lead with the heart of a servant, to serve.
Mm.
Because servant leadership is not a leader
honorable.
That has many servants.
It's
the one that puts their life down for the betterment of others. And Africa will only prosper when we put ourselves last, but Africans first. Well, when we put the continent first.
This is such this. First of all, I love this. I feel like, and I'm not a religious man, but I feel like I go to church.
Hallelujah.
I love this.
And I'm just a businessman.
I know, Bonang, but this is what I love about you. Such a mix of interesting things. So first of all, your point about how business must do good to do well. I love that, because I think so often we pit society against business. We look at business, and you've experienced this as a CEO, as being this parasitic thing that takes what it wants out of people and throws the carcass to the ground afterwards. It sucks out all of their valuable stuff and throws them away. And that people resent work, which is not how it should be. Work is fulfilling. And in healthy people, in healthy societies, having meaning is very often derived from work, being able to create things, being able to add value to society, being able to take home money for your family. These are positive things. These are not negative things. And the other thing I like that you point out there is essentially agency.
Exactly.
Like, no matter who you are in the hierarchy, in a business or in a society or in a corporation or in a government or wherever, you can decide to help those people who are underneath you in the hierarchy. You can help the people above you. You can be a part of making things go right, or you can be a part of making things go wrong. We get trapped in a lot of pessimism, and we have various reasons for that. Our history has made it hard for us to be optimistic. because people have been treated very badly in South Africa for many hundreds of years. And as a result, we have various complexes. People have inferiority and superiority complexes, neither of whom deserve those. Where do we begin to change things in an attitude, the way you seem to have learned from your grandmother and from various other influences in your life that you highlight in your book? How do we get that to happen for everybody? Because not everybody had your grandmother.
So it starts first at a personal level. And it says, because we are imperfect by design, how then do we mitigate that? Most people, when confronted with choices between A or B, they would want to choose either A or B. Very few say, but why should I choose? Why can't I have both A and B? Hmm. To be able to hold two conflicting ideas in your mind and still be able to function. Business will say, no, we must have growth. Labor will say, no, we must transform. So as a people, why don't we grow and transform? It's not either or, but it is both and together at the same time, concurrently, simultaneously, in parallel. That's where our salvation comes from. So for me, in writing the book, I'm saying business, first and foremost, must start by saying, we have a problem. Mm. Remember, it is business, especially in mining, that benefited from cheap labor.
Yeah.
From labor reserves.
Right.
That benefited from land expropriation without compensation, dispossession, and people were moved from Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland into compounds, single-sex hostels, worse like animals. Mm. So today, 24 years into democracy, business must say, you know what? We have a problem. We have aided and abetted this. So to get the legitimacy we want, first of all, we must fess up. And then say, what are we going to do about it? Therefore, what I am proposing in the book, it says, when you think of the three ideas that have conquered the world in the 21st century, of democracy, of capitalism, and peace as a way of resolving conflict, mm-hmm. you then say, in that environment, can you have business, human rights, and the legitimacy of capitalism sitting by side by side, so that we emerge at the place that says, although I'm business, can I have conscientious capital that is geared towards first and foremost doing good? Because again, the way we are brought up, it says, isn't it amazing that the people who wake up in the morning and say, I want to make money, don't have any? But yet people who wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to follow my passion, even though I'm not paid for it, make money until it comes out of their ears. Therefore, the founder of Mac Sharp and Dome, William E. Mac, they have a presence in 222 countries and locations. Yeah. Like every other company, when you walk into their reception, you see a vision statement, mission statement, but they've got something much more profound. The founding words of William E. Mac when he started the company. He says, we try and remember that medicines is for the people and not for the money. The more we have remembered that, the more money we have made. Therefore, the purpose of business is not to make money. The purpose of business is to survive. Because if the business can survive, it will make money until it comes out of your ears. Mm. Therefore, for me, there are only two functions for a business. One is to deliver on what you say and you promise. Well, how difficult can that be? And then lastly, it's about doing no harm. This is the part that we don't realize as intrinsic, essential, and critical to business. You can't open up a mind and you do harm. Harm to your own employees. Harm to the community where you're located. Harm to the society. Harm to the environment. If the leaders of Marikana had walked through the informal settlement and said, but these are our colleagues who live like pigs, what can we do to use the might, the force, the impetus of a business to make sure that they've got a roof over their head with bricks and mortar? Mm-hmm. If they thought that way, there's a humanity that needs to be found in business that affects your own employees, and the positive predisposition you get from society ensures that they choose you over your competitors. That's what we call sustainability.
And that's also what we call the free market.
Exactly. That's what we call resilience, because resilience, especially in Africa, must be much, much more than just food energy water nexus. It must be how we feel about each other and how we think our purpose is, and to really absolutely humble ourselves, be vulnerable and say, it's only when I see humanity in myself, it's personal, that I can recognize humanity in you. In isiZulu, that's why when I look at you, I say, sawubona ukuba umuntu.
I see you.
Ngiyawubona ukuthi umuntu. I'm acknowledging your humanity. If I acknowledge that, I have to treat you like I would treat my very own. Imagine if you had a partner, lifetime partner, and say, I'll take as many kisses as I want and I'll leave you the way you are. But it's about starting by saying, how do you want to be kissed? How do you want to be touched? Where you get joy. Other, not self-centered.
Yeah. Why are there so many people? And it's about a self-worth, self-critic balance as well, right? Why are there so many people who allow themselves to be walked over, trodden on, treated as other, treated as subhuman? Because there are loads of people in this country, and it's not their fault. I'm not by any means ascribing fault to it. But how is it possible that there are so many people who allow themselves to be cast aside by businesses, by governments, by their own family members? I mean, we have hideous, hideous statistics. You bring up the positive ones, but we look at statistics about women abuse and things like this in South Africa. Most of those women are abused by people who they know.
Exactly.
Who are supposed to love and care for them. There's something very, very wrong. There's something ill about society at that level.
Yeah. And again, it starts by saying, let's recognize that by nature, we are faulty. When you ask many people, 90% of people, that's how business is created, by the way. You say, if there was one thing about your body that you'd change, what would it be? 99% of the people are not happy with the bodies they have. Sure. They want to change something. So business comes where women with small breasts, they go to constructive surgeons and say, make my breast larger. The ones with large breasts say, no, make my breast smaller. And this is a continuous cycle that creates business. So when you ask J-Lo, the most beautiful woman and beautiful soul, say, I've got too big a bum. Some women pay plastic surgeons to make their bum look like that of J-Lo.
Yeah.
Then it says, let me learn to love the body that I've been given. In business, let me play the cards that I've been given. I didn't choose my own deck. That's what I've got. That's what I do. So, first, it's about self-worth, self-love.
Yeah.
It's about self-care. But also, it's about a realization that nobody can help me without my permission.
Pumi said this morning, because we were talking about exactly this, we've almost come full circle. She said, because we were talking about, we don't know if we're in the perfect shape for summer, you know, that kind of thing. How healthy do we feel? Pumi said, the beach is getting the body it deserves. And she's going to the beach and she's going to use that body.
Exactly.
And Tate Mohale is giving me life today, validating everything I've been saying here since 6 a.m. Thank you.
Thank you, my dear. It must be a black thing. But also, it's about allowing other people to define what good looks like for yourself.
Yeah.
So we have a Pretoria high school for girls. They have the temerity in the assessment of their facts to say, your hair that is God-given, that comes out of your skull, Kelly, and beautiful and magnificent in its glory, it's not acceptable. By whose standard? So when we say beauty is a size 8 dress, a Barbie doll, by whose standard? Because African people are very well endowed with public opinions. We pull caravans and we are curvaceous. That's what we fall in love with. If you allow people to define what beauty is for you, good looks like, you'll end up believing that Jesus is white. And you disregard the fact that it was the Moor people of a darker hue, because the Bible says Moses was black, who built the pyramids, and they brought civilization to Europe. And we lost that abilities and capabilities. When you wake up every day, somebody looks at you and say, you look sick, you look sick. After 3 days, you will feel sick, you'll manifest being sick. But when you look at yourself every morning and say, I am black and beautiful, the closest thing since sliced bread. This is the manifestation of God personified. And you say that three times to yourself, you'll end up thinking that that's what beauty looks like. 90% of the 58 million South Africans are not white. And yet our standard of beauty, it's white. Religion, imagine, this is what scares me the most. We call ourselves Christians and we think that's what God gave us. And I ask myself and say, imagine if we were colonized by the Indians. We'll all be Hindus.
The Hindus, yeah.
Imagine if we were colonized by the biggest economy in the world, China. We'll all be Buddhists. Therefore, we didn't choose to be Christians. We let somebody else define the agenda for us. The day we wake up in the morning and say, this is Africa. It has the three biggest rivers in the world, including the mighty Zambezi that pummels at the Vic Falls at 547,000 tons of water per second, enough to generate hydroelectric power for the continent.
South America just called and said the Amazon's right up there, so you can't claim all three.
Yeah, absolutely. But remember, of the biggest rivers in the world, three of them are found in this continent.
Sure.
But we don't think of it as a source of energy.
No.
The sun in Africa is free. The sun is free.
This is that self-worth thing that I'm talking about. And you're addressing exactly that for me, because I think there's so many people who go through life comparing themselves with everyone else.
Mm.
And this is a big problem all over the world. You've got it in every corner. People go, Pumi has this kind of life. She has this much money in the bank. She drives this kind of car. She has this kind of child. She has this sort of lunch appointment today. And someone will say that's better than mine in every one of those categories. And they'll be jealous of her. And that will wear them down and hold them down. And they won't be able to ever get to the level of happy that they think Pumi's going through. But there's also someone who's much happier than Pumi, who thinks Pumi and her standards are too low.
Have you seen Oprah dancing? She's happier than me.
Exactly.
But this is the point, and she doesn't care.
That's
right?
It. So real joy starts by saying, everywhere, in everything that I do, there'll always be people that are better than me, and I'll always be the one that's better than most.
Mm.
It's just a fact. There'll always be people that have more money than me. I'll also have more money than most people. There'll always be people that are fatter than me, smaller than me, taller than me. It's just accepting it. It then says, how do I make the most of what God has given me? And if you are happy with that, and for me, let me just say these three things. To really find meaning, purpose, joy, it's about saying, I want to be happy with myself and live in the present moment. Not too much in the past, not too much in the future. Let me just smell the coffee now and touch the rose now. And be in the moment. Secondly, it says, I need to develop close, personal, intimate relationships with other human beings. Not with walls. Not with cars. With other human beings. Because when you do things only for yourself, you take them with you to the grave. When you do them for others, this is what we call a legacy. You live it so that that's how you are remembered. And then lastly, it's about balance. So when you go to Greece and in the temple of Apollo, the big two wooden doors open and you look right at the temple. There's a big inscription and it says, know thyself. When you get closer at the bottom, it says, everything in moderation. Now, if we applied only those two, I know who I am because I'm firmly rooted. I'm centered. I know my true worth. Secondly, everything in moderation. I drink, but in moderation. I party, but in moderation. I eat, but in moderation. I indulge, but in moderation. The world will be a much better place.
Why are you smiling like that, Sia?
Ooh, wee.
Sia's loving this. Yeah, this is probably your best day ever.
Well, no, really.
And we are talking about the book.
Everything
lift,
in moderation.
Lift as you rise. So it says when you palate and highlight others, you get real joy.
Who is this book for? Who did you have in mind when you wrote it? Because I'm sure it's for everybody and all of us can learn something from it, probably more than just one thing. But who did you write it thinking about?
So I said, you know, when you have been a leader for as long as I've been, I started working on the 17th of April 1984.
Yo.
I became a managing director of the world's biggest and oldest elevator company, Otis, in my early 20s. So even if you are thick, you learn something because you hear from others and you reflect this, you emulate others. I said, surely I have something to share. Therefore, first was to share it with ourselves so that again, we archive our own material. Secondly, that we scaffold the work of people who came before us. And then lastly, it's about saying, can we give an insight to others who are compatriots so that they understand where we come from? So that they can understand that they cannot speak about our poverty theoretically. That to us is a lived experience and they need to become, allow us space to use our own agency to say that's what poverty feels like. Because most people think that being poor is when you have pissed off your parents, you didn't do your homework, and they banish you to your own room upstairs to eat alone. And they think that's poverty. They don't know what it is like to go for days without having a meal. They don't know what it is like for children today, 24 years into democracy, who walk for 2 hours to school in the morning and 2 hours back. They don't know that we still kill people in the most violent, painful death when all they want to do is to go to the toilet and they fall into a pit latrine, and yet we waste 100 billion South African rands to the Guptas and to the Zuma family. Imagine how many pit latrines would have built. There are still schools, not just in the Eastern Cape, where it's still 2 classes in one because there are not enough bricks and mortar, and yet we waste every year 80 billion rands, as told by the Auditor General, in irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure.
Yo.
There are still schools today in South Africa where our children learn under the trees because they don't have classrooms, and yet business looks by and it's going to claim that, but we didn't know. That's why we wrote the book, and the book simply says, you know, there are most amazing things that happen to this country. 80% of the things we do are amazing and world class. The 20% where we mess up in a big way. There's a lot of hope. That's why we are called the miracle nation. That's why we are called the rainbow nation. And the reason that is like that is because our forebears came to the negotiating table, not so much looking at what they can take away from the table for themselves, but prepared to give up something. So today we want to implore business to say, for us to get out of this financial crisis, what are you as business prepared to give up? You can't just be demanding your growth. You must say, surely this economy must be broadly reflective of our demographics. This is not an outpost of Europe. It's full of black people. There's more women than men, and yet we pay women today 73% of what we pay men for work of equal value. There are more young people in this country than old people. 35 years and younger are more than 60% of the population. And yet, last year, there were 5.9 million of them who were unemployed.
That's
this
right.
year, it's 6.2 million of them. And yet, as business, we say we want to treat Africa's children as our very own. Which father will go to work knowing that I've left my child at home hopeless, jobless, and therefore rudderless, when we know that the devil finds work for idle hands? There's 10 million of these young people that are not in education, employment, or training. What are we doing as business to make sure that we obliterate this scourge? Because it's when we think that way. You know, it's fair to say in South Africa today, in this country, when so many of us dare to hope, that many white people didn't ask for forgiveness for apartheid. 350 years of apartheid. The UN called it a crime against humanity. They just took forgiveness. They didn't ask for it. Contrition is an ongoing process. Therefore, you have to continue asking for forgiveness, and you have to forever remain grateful for the mercy shown. South Africans are arrogant. We voted and they said, no, these blacks must lift themselves up with their own boots and bootstraps. And they've got no boots and no bootstraps. Business is so arrogant that it says, let's just get on with it. These black people are the majority anyway. They will eventually become MDs. But how is it sustainable when 1% of the population owns 90% of the assets? How can it be sustainable when only 10% of the population occupy 70% of positions of leadership? Therefore, if we don't attend to it because it's manifestly in business's own interest, I think we'll be failing this country, this hope that is ever rising, this notion that says this is the era for Africa, because there's 1.2 billion of us out of 7 billion people, and this continent has everything that God can probably give to any continent. We should learn from Japan, that 127 million people, but they work themselves up to be the second biggest
from
country.
From nothing.
And the only country that says we know what it is like to be hit with an atomic bomb. Two. There's no other. Absolutely. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they live to tell the tale. Even what nature throws at them. Fukushima, we've just seen it. They recovered out of quicker than Russia did out of their own nuclear disaster.
With Chernobyl, yeah.
Yes, because they know how to mobilize forces. If we spend as much time as South Africans just thinking about our own personal growth and development and how to build this continent like we do fighting, will be the greatest country in the world. Because if you think about it, labor hates business.
Yeah.
Business thinks labor is a problem. Government does not trust business. Civil society says, who trusts government? We spend more than 70% of our waking life as South Africans prepared to go to war with each other. Whereas the war is out there, the enemy is out there. The yeah. enemy is poverty. The enemy is people who are eating our lunch. The enemy is cheap imports yeah. from China. The enemy is the jobs that the Chinese create in the African continent when men and women in Emondlo and Enkandla and Ngqutu, in Langanyanga and Kukuletu have nothing to do. And you don't need a matric certificate to work in a farm. You don't need a matric certificate to work in the mines.
No.
We are so obsessed with academic qualifications, and yet we have only moved people who go to university from 5% in apartheid to 11%.
It's hardly anything.
And we are not crying, and we are not worried that 1.1 million of our children start grade one, but only 672,000 end up writing grade 12. What happens to the other half? Nobody is asking the questions. We spend 50 billion on TVET colleges. Completion rate is 3%. This is the most
outrageous.
Classical case of irregular, fruitless expenditure. There's no return on investment. We spend more on education, 10 times more than Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. And yet our outcomes are the poorest. In 1996, a study was done. It's now called the PIRLS study, P-I-R-L-S. And it says 80% of grade fours in South Africa cannot read with comprehension. In spite of the money that we spend. We spend more on healthcare than all the African countries, and yet the outcomes in terms of infant mortality, morbidity, and mortality are the worst than that of Zimbabwe. We are the only country in the African continent that became free, and we inherited an apartheid education, and we didn't improve on it. We degraded it. Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, mm-hmm. 10 years into democracy, 80% literacy rate. Even today, with all the challenges that Gabriel Robert Mugabe has, he can still boast of 94% literacy. What do we boast of as South Africans in education? And yet we know that education is the only thing that will make ordinary people born in Alexander to transcend social classes. That to me is the purpose of business. That's why I wrote the book.
So how does business leadership South Africa factor into all of this? Because that's your corporate role now. And you have to bring together so many interests. And you have to try and direct them in a positive way. I mean, how many companies are we talking about here?
So it's 86 CEOs of large companies. 53 of them are responsible for more than half the GDP of this country.
Wow.
And we're saying when, and they employ 13.5 million of the 16.2 million that are gainfully employed. 7 million
By
of
far
them
the majority.
Informal. Absolutely. Government only 1.3 million. When you include provinces and local government, it's 2.3 million people. So when business transformed, South Africa would be transformed. Therefore, we're saying, let's help business leadership South Africa to think seriously about their role that they can play. To say, how does a business that is imbued with a position of influence behave when we are in a crisis? How does it think about these issues? That's why we have a new BLSA, a new strategy, and we say, first and foremost, we stand for inclusive socio-economic growth and transformation. Number two, we say, we stand for the protection of key state institutions because the Zuma regime wanted to kill this. Lastly, we say, can we position business as a national asset? We say, let's think critically about our role. Gone are the days when we blamed labor, that they strike for too long, they demand more money. Gone are the days when we looked at government and said, no, you must create a conducive environment where business can thrive. No, you must give us regulatory certainty and policy stability. We're saying, what can we do? And we are clear at BLSA that we want to lead in not 1,001 little things of less impact. We want to lead in big things that will give us the highest impact and a step change. We must be clear about our support for land reform, not just expropriation without compensation, because it's the right thing to do. Number two, we must lead in transformation so that these businesses look like us. Number three, we must lead in ensuring that we get ourselves out of this recession, because business can do that. Government can only come up with pronouncements, but business has the money, has the know-how, they know project
it's
management.
It's like job creation.
Exactly.
Government can't do that.
Absolutely. And fourthly, I think we also need to be clear about it's business that must lead so that this economy grows. Because if the economy doesn't grow, very soon we'll be talking about distributing poverty, not wealth. The redistribution must be of wealth. So black people are demanding to participate in the economy, not so that they take, but say, allow us to participate in the economy so that we benefit now, but also we contribute towards growing the pie. Because if we participate, very soon there'll be nothing. The last two is about creating jobs for that self-wealth, self-respect. Because when you are a man in Alexander, you look at your wife and your young kids and you can't provide for them, you lose your sense of purpose. You end up doing things that are totally and absolutely immoral. Lastly, we need to be very serious but intentional about education. At the moment, our educational system is going the wrong way. And I think we need to accept that and correct it and course correct, because we want to be the most educated country in the world. Not academically obsessed. Because what we need...
You're not for qualification.
No, absolutely. We need artisans.
Yeah.
Economies are built on people who create goods and services that the world needs, and so that you can call your price. Plumbers, electricians, millwrights, lift mechanics... why does anybody who wants to fix a BMW need a grade 12? And in Germany, you don't do that. But why are we doing it? Why would we be obsessed with outcome-based education, which is only in developed countries when we are a developing country? Why don't we learn from Rwanda? This is a country that when we went to the polls, 17th of April, 1994, they were going through the worst genocide. But in 20 years, of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world, Rwanda... Seven of them are in Africa. Rwanda is one of them. But what they've done, the gender pay gap, they are the fourth in the world. Number one is Iceland. They did it in a short period of time. Today, when they speak, the Rwandans, they say, after the genocide, we no longer have Tutsis and Hutus, only Rwandans. The same way that the people in Japan, when they speak, taxi drivers and business say, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In Russia, they say, post the 1917 Russian Revolution. In Angola, they say, after Savimbi died, we had new hope. We found our mojo. In South Africa, I submit, we're going to wake up one day and fully appreciate the moment of the 19th of December, 2017, when we were gifted with Matamela, Cyril Ramaphosa, as the president of the ANC, because we changed the course of state capture in this country. We're going to look back and say, post the advent of the new dawn, we became a prosperous nation.
A lot of people are criticizing the president, though, because they think he's moving too slowly. So I want you, because you know him and because you know other people in business and you know people who are making changes as we speak, that there are lots of things going on that sometimes take a bit of time. We expect, like we drive up to a takeaway place and we get our food straight away. We're expecting instant results. If we go on the internet, we want to find the story that we're interested in. If we are looking for a song, we can find it immediately. This is not how massive change happens. It doesn't happen instantaneously.
Absolutely.
So explain to me, because you've spoken to the president, and give people who might be cynical about how slow the progress has been, not just in the last year with our new president, but over the last 20 years, that expect maybe too much. Maybe our expectations were outrageous. Maybe there are things that we could have done better to accelerate those changes. But help me understand it.
Cliff, you know, what you say is so profound. And let me try and explain slow to you. So slow is a 24-year-old democracy where we have added 500,000 black families into the middle class a year every year. There are very few economies in the world that are able to do that. We compare ourselves with economies that are centuries old. Slow for me is a president that ascended in Nasrec and very quickly thereafter forced a sitting president in charge of the intelligence and the army to resign on the 14th of February to be inaugurated on the 15th of February to read the State of the Nation address that was written for then President Jacob Zuma. How can that be slow? In that first State of the Nation address, he makes 23 changes. He gets rid of 10 ministers that aided and abetted state capture. Yes, he left 20 other thieves. But you understand in politics that things work differently. Politics are not business. Business is not politics. That's why as business people, we don't pretend like we are politicians. That's why civil society shouldn't pretend like they are politicians. But we know that he's managing his own things. But also he has said, we are going to be a country of laws, not of men. The previous regime did everything that they wanted. Every day, there's a revelation, there's a shock about how deep and how wide the state capture project did. This yesterday, we had former minister Ngwakora Matlodi. I mean, it is blood chilling what you hear. We had Barbara Hogan. We had Praveen God. We had Mkebisi Jonas. When you listen, you can understand that this wasn't an accident. This was a systematic and systemic planned process that the president embarked on to embark on an industrial scale looting to benefit only two families. But he also told us that he'll do three things. Cabinet reshuffle that he did. He said, number two, the people who did things that they shouldn't have done, like the Stina Dairy Farm, VBS, must go to jail. So it will reduce some of the thieves in parliament. Lastly, he said, my cabinet is too big at 33. Nelson Mandela's was 20, Thabo Mbeki's was 23. This one ballooned to 37. So he's going to reduce that. So let's give him time. He's going to deal with it. But also, how do you behave as a president that is committed to your own party's unity, to renewal, and to economic revival? You then say, let me hold it together until May. May is only 5 months away. And then after May, the Pope can dance.
So really, things are exciting. We're in the moment of history now.
So I think patience is being able to see the bigger picture and say 24 years in a history of a nation, it's nothing.
Yeah.
When you go to Oxford, there are buildings that were built in 1604. When you go to Cambridge, there are buildings that are still standing in the 1300s. Here, we've only been free on the 17th of April, 1994. Yes, we've done a number of things wrong, but we've done amazing things right. So as South Africans, imagine if we all put our hands together, shoulder to the wheel, business, government, labor, and civil society, and we stopped fighting with one another and said, we will do it for the good of Mandela's country, for nation building, for social cohesion. You know, sometimes in the Bible, we call things miracles, but when they're actually quite logical. So the second miracle that Jesus did after turning water into wine, he says, when the people were going on picnic, that's what I'll call it. It's called the parable of the four pieces of bread and the two pieces of fish. But when you look at that, the miracle was not that everybody got fed and there was a lot that's left over. The miracle in that parable, it says, when all of us go on picnic, we take much more than we need. We always bring something back. So when we put everything centrally and then we share, there will always be something left over. Therefore, the lesson for me says there's enough wealth in the world to feed all 7 billion of us. There's enough money in South Africa. We collected 2 trillion South African rands last financial year. There before, 1.144 trillion rands. You divide that by 58 million South Africans, there's no reason why anybody should go too hungry. When we share more than what we keep, there shouldn't be anybody that is wanting. The problem with the world is that we are greedy. We want much, much more. When you steal $4 billion from Nigeria's fiscus, this will last you 3 lifetimes. Why would you do that when God has given you only 1 lifetime? So I think we need to change the mentality of the people of South Africans. When you look at the people in Stellenbosch, today Stellenbosch factually has the highest per capita dollar billionaires.
Hmm. of any city in the world.
Exactly. So imagine if those people said, we'll create our farms and open them up and hire more people for the sake of hiring them, because we want to do no harm.
Hmm. When you write a book like this, there's so much material. I mean, a lot of these are speeches that you've already given. There are also the contributions from other people. I mean, I find a lot of it is fascinating, because it also tells a bit about your story. Was it for you something that was difficult to do? Did it take a long time, or was it easy? Did it come to you very simply? Did you sit there and go, yes, I'll put that in, I'll throw that out, I'll keep this, and it was straightforward?
It was a 9-month project, at least at the time that I was putting it together. So it's hard work. But transformation is hard work. Hard work has never killed any Mohale that I know. If it was easy, everybody would do it. It is the hard in it that makes it great.
Yeah.
So when we opt for easy things, then we are not going to get the change that we want. I think we need to learn from salmons. You know, a salmon swims upstream and sometimes against a waterfall.
Mm.
And 60% yeah, of them
they
succeed.
Yeah.
So if all we did was just to relax and be taken by the tide and take the path of least resistance, we'll accomplish nothing. So writing a book is hard, but it's precisely because it's hard that you do it. Being a leader is hard, because you're going to be pillaged, you're going to be pummeled, you're going to be called names, but you still choose leadership to say, I'm going to do it in the best interest of others. Therefore, writing a book is about being vulnerable. And so I'm going to take my story and put it out there, hoping that a small boy that is born in Katlong says, if Bonang can do it, surely I can. So that you inspire, you motivate, you give hope. Because that's all that we can do. Napoleon says, leaders are dealers in hope. Hmm. Our job is to say, even in the dark clouds, in the midnight hour, when friends have left you all alone, when tears roll down your face, the sun is still going to shine tomorrow. And tomorrow, on a composite basis, is going to be substantially better than today. That is the stuff of leadership.
I love it. I love the book. It's called Lift As You Rise, Speeches and Thoughts on Leadership. Bonang Mohale, it's a pleasure to see you. It's a great pleasure for you to address us all this morning and to share some of your insights and share some of that terrific inspiration that you are certainly the one of the greatest purveyors of in this country, and we've got to keep remembering what you tell us.
Cliff, thank you so much for having me. Wow. And for the most incredible pleasure. Opportunity just to share some of my wacky ideas.
No, they're not so wacky. They're pretty sensible, if you ask me. Thank you so much. Bonang Mohale, everybody. It is just before 9 o'clock, cliffcentral.com. Stick around. There's a lot of good stuff coming up today. It is a busy Thursday. Cliffcentral.com.